right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Today is June 3rd, 2026. And our top story this morning is oil. WTI crude is back above $96 per barrel, up almost $10 just since Friday as the air quote ceasefire continues to escalate. And it escalated particularly yesterday and overnight. We had the U.S. disabled a ship that was trying to run the blockade into Iran. They put a Hellfire missile in the engine room. That has a funny way of stopping ships very abruptly when you do that. Iran wasn't so happy about that, go figure, and they sent dozens of missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones into Bahrain and Kuwait in retaliation for that. The airport in Kuwait was hit, or an airport in Kuwait was hit. At least one person was killed there, a civilian. No reports of any U.S. casualties here. In retaliation for that retaliation, the U.S. bombed targets on Kesham Island. So, yeah, peace negotiations obviously going very well, as always. We are caught in this loop of jawbone shoot, and maybe, just maybe, oil is starting to realize this whole, you know, we've been minutes away from a peace deal for about a month and a half now. It's kind of bullshit. Maybe the market's starting to realize that. Oil is higher this morning on that news. Now, even as that is going on, we're starting to get these stories in particular. Pakistan and India appear particularly vulnerable to what's going on in oil prices. We've got our first stories about demand destruction in Pakistan, pretty striking amounts of demand destruction in Pakistan going on here. Gasoline sales are down 12% year over year. That's sales by volume, mind you, not dollar amounts. Down 12% year over year, and diesel sales in Pakistan down 32% year over year. That is an instant recession. In a bucket right there, when your diesel demand goes down by 32% year over year, that is trucks just not moving stuff around in the economy. So Pakistan is feeling the pinch. And India, some interesting headlines out of India today. We reported earlier this week how Bloomberg Economics had speculated that the Reserve Bank of India had sold gold. And that would be big news that India has been trying to defend their currency. The rupee has been in free fall versus the dollar, mainly driven by what's going on in the Middle East and the Strait of Hormuz. They have to raise dollars to buy oil at a higher price, which means their currency is suffering from that. Now, the story was that they sold gold, and India is out denying that they sold gold. But if you look at the denial, they're not really denying it. They're denying it, but not. And I'll explain that to you as we get through that article. But that is interesting this morning. And India is also cutting taxes to attract foreign bond investors now. Again, this is all centered around defending the rupee, which is collapsing against the dollar. India and Pakistan particularly vulnerable to these big swings in oil prices. Now, the other main story that's going on this morning, 2025 called and wants its headline back. Looks like tariffs are back on the menu, boys. President Trump has announced 10 to 12.5% tariffs on 60 countries over forced labor. Okay, forced labor, something I've personally never once heard President Trump talk about, forced labor, but now we're very passionate about that, and so we're putting tariffs on because we're very passionate about forced labor, which, hey, I'm not saying it's not a problem. I'm just saying I've never once heard the guy talk about it ever, and all of a sudden we're using that for tariffs. So what's really going on here? These are Section 301 tariffs, Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. They launched these investigations after the Supreme Court struck down the IEEPA tariffs, said they were unconstitutional. President Trump said, okay, we're going to use this other act, Section 122, to put 10% tariffs on the whole world. Those 122 section tariffs were only good for 150 days. We're coming up on 150 days. They're about to expire. And like magic, all of a sudden, we've got these Section 301 tariffs over forced labor. So what's going on here? They started with the tariffs that they want. And then he told his people, go search through the laws, find some loophole, give me a legal basis for this. And they found it. And today it's forced labor. That's what they're doing. Meanwhile, we got a couple other things going on. Bitcoin slide continues. It was a brutal day for Bitcoin yesterday. We now have a 66 handle on Bitcoin. We were about 66,900 when I hit the record button here. Bitcoin has had a really rough couple of days, and it all seems to stem from Michael Saylor's strategy selling 32 Bitcoin. 32 billion dollars worth of Bitcoin. No, they sold 32 Bitcoin, and Bitcoin has crashed almost $10,000 on that news. And Strategy owns like 840,000 Bitcoin combined. So if this is really why Bitcoin is selling off so heavy, this 32 Bitcoin that was sold by Strategy, if that's really what's driving the $10,000 sell-offs, then we have a very big Michael Saylor problem on our hands, folks, because they're going to have to keep selling Bitcoin because Stretch, Saylor's infinite money glitch, which, oh, breaking news, infinite money glitches are not, in fact, infinite. Yeah, his infinite money glitch is glitching and it's not working, and they had to sell a paltry amount of Bitcoin, and the market freaked TF out over it. Keep an eye on Bitcoin. Again, guys, we have several months of Bitcoin winter. According to the typical halving calendar, we would not expect to see a bottom until almost November of this year. So we could go a lot lower between now and then. We've got Morningstar is out with a report. This one is pretty interesting. Yesterday, Morningstar says the SpaceX is only worth about half of what they're selling in the IPO for. They came out with about $740 billion was the valuation. Don't quote me on that exact number, but it was a seven handle. 700 and change billion dollar valuation for SpaceX. What's the big difference? According to Morningstar, as you may have guessed, XAI was what drives the wild difference between what Elon Musk is saying and what Morningstar says SpaceX is worth. Again, guys, if you're interested in this IPO because you like rocket ships, and I like rocket ships, I got my Darth here going on over the shoulder. I'm all into the space thing. I love it. But SpaceX is not a space company. SpaceX is an AI company now that does rockets on the side. And that is why you've got this big difference. They are saying XAI, and the potential for value destruction at XAI is why they arrive at such a smaller number. But remember, they changed all the rules for the indexes to force passive investors to buy this stuff. So the stock's probably going to rip on the IPO. Just make sure you understand what you're buying, folks, because sooner or later, math and valuations are going to matter. Maybe it ain't today, but some point it's going to matter again. And by the way, to all the indexes that are changing the rules to allow SpaceX to basically be crammed into the indexes and Anthropic and OpenAI along with them, I have a question. Why were those rules put in place to begin with? Why did we have those? And let me go out on a limb here and say the answer was probably to protect investors from speculative things, to allow price discovery before people piled in, right? Probably some form of investor protection is why we had those rules to begin with. And then my follow-up question would be, why does that need for investor protection not apply to the biggest speculative mania in investing history? Something I can't help but wonder. Also going on, speaking of the biggest mania in history and protecting investors, Anthropic doesn't want to share financial data with their private credit lenders. That's interesting. Do you ever go to like borrow money from somebody and they say, okay, let's do a credit check on you? And you're like, oh no, you can't have any of my information. I just want you to lend me the money. Just try that when you go to buy a car or a mortgage from a house. When they ask you for information, say no and see how that works for you. Apparently, Anthropic thinks that'll work for them. The portion of their debt that is not backstopped by Broadcom, their supplier, the portion that they're not co-signing for, it's only about $5 billion. Anthropic doesn't want to share financial information with the lenders of people looking to buy those notes. Which, by the way, if you just filed for your IPO and you're trying to jam your IPO out the door, aren't you going to go public with that information in like a week anyway? What the hell is going on at Anthropic here? But remember, private lenders, private credit space, rigorous due diligence. That's what the private credit people tell us, right? Rigorous due diligence, even though the people borrowing the money don't give out any information. We had one yesterday I was scratching my head at. We got the JOLTS, or Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, came out. JOLTS counts the number of job openings in the U.S. economy. And it went up by 731,000 jobs last month. 731 job openings, almost entirely in professional and business services. And if somebody wants to explain how that's possible to me, I'd just love to hear it. Because I looked at that number, and me and Mish were talking about that this morning. We're trying to figure out some explanation for it. Okay, maybe it's FIFA hiring. I don't know why FIFA would hire professional business services, but you know, you got the World Cup is coming to the U.S. Maybe, or just maybe this data is complete garbage. And that's the simplest explanation I arrive at. You've got the job market is so bad that college graduates are booing at commencement ceremonies. And think about it. When's the last time you heard about people booing at a graduation? That just doesn't happen. But it's happening now because the job market sucks so much. But the government wants us to believe that almost 750,000 jobs just poof magically appeared last month, despite headline after headline about job cuts. Okay. We got ADP private payrolls came out with a much more believable 122,000 jobs added for the month of May. Again, that's just barely keeping up with population growth. So that's not enough to really change the unemployment rate. We get the non-farm payrolls, aka the jobs report on Friday from the government. That's the more important one. The market will be looking to that one. And we've got some private credit and private equity stories to close out the show. Cliffwater has capped withdrawals at 5%. They've capped at 5% despite requests for 17% of investors wanting their money back. Now, that's interesting because Cliffwater capped redemptions last quarter at 5% after 14% of people wanted their money back. So now we're up. We've actually got things have gotten worse in private credit, according to Cliffwater. Remember, the headlines went away for about 3 months just because we were in between quarterly reports. And the private credit people and the Blue Owl guys were like, oh, don't worry. The worst is behind us. The bottom is in. Nope. It was getting worse the whole time. They just now have to tell us about that in their quarterly reports. So we are going to see more and more stories like this in the weeks ahead. And then we've got Partners Group Holdings. They're doing the same thing. They're capping redemptions at 5% despite 9.8% requests. But the difference here, Partners Group Holdings is not a private credit fund. Partners Group Holdings is a private equity fund. They don't own debt. They own companies. This is the first time I've heard of a private equity fund capping redemptions because of a scramble for liquidity. That's interesting. It's not just in private credit. But as always, they're like, don't worry. My net asset value is so good and the marks are completely made up. Trust me, bro. We'll talk about why that is complete horse manure as well. Guys, we got a lot to talk about this morning. Let's shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance today. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm so you can have your coffee with the melon heads tomorrow. Because we do this every business day. Right now, stocks are in the red just a little bit. 12 points lower for the S&P, off by 0.16%. The Dow is down 173 points, or about a third of a percent in the red this morning. And the NASDAQ is still up because my tech stocks higher by 34 points or 0.11%. Maybe Jensen Huang said somebody else should be a trillion-dollar company this morning, and that's why the NASDAQ is still positive by 30 points. We've got a stronger dollar this morning. This is almost certainly being driven by oil prices, 99.44 for the Dixie, up by 23 basis points. That's not going to help Pakistan or India. Looking over at the bond market, we've got yields higher on the long end. Again, probably oil prices driving that. The 30-year yield is at 4.989%, higher by 2 points and change. The 10-year yield, 4.492, up by 3.5 points. The 2-year, 4.084, up by 3 points and change. And the 1 month is actually down a fraction of a point at 3.685. We talked about Bitcoin, and here we are looking at daily candles on the Bitcoin chart, and this one is ugly. Look at that two-day sell-off there. We started this about 74,000, currently 67,000 even. Rough couple of days, and again, this all started 2 days ago when we heard that Sailor Strategy had sold 32 Bitcoin to pay stretch dividends, and that kicked off a sell-off that's, I guess, about $7,000 now. We were as low as 65,300. We bounced off that level here. If you look, the RSI for Bitcoin is getting way, way down there here. We're currently at, an RSI of about 23, seriously oversold. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a little bit of a short-term bounce in Bitcoin here, just because you never stay this oversold for long. That being said, there are several months, at least 4 or 5 months of Bitcoin winter remaining here. I don't think we've seen the bottom here, guys. I've got my eye on 49,000 as the bottom for this cycle. If 49,000 doesn't hold, 25. And I think it's going to take a big blow up on the scale of FTX to hit that lower band there. But Right now, 49 is the level I'm eyeballing. Looking over at the commodities board, gold is lower this morning, $4,463 for spot gold, off by almost 25 bucks or 0.55% lower. Spot silver is also down at 74.42. That's lower by 70 cents or a little less than 1%. But I still like the shiny, but metals are reacting to that stronger dollar and higher rates here. Once again, if oil goes up, gold and silver go down along with stocks. It's just the way things are right now since this war began. Copper is lower by 1.5%. Platinum lower by 1.25%. Palladium off by 1.7%. And there's crude oil. It's looks like it's off as high as of the mornings, $95.18 for WTI crude, higher by $1.41. Now, we were up over 96 just a few moments ago. So, I don't know, maybe we've got more jawboning going on here. We went as high this morning as $97 per barrel for WTI crude, up almost 10 bucks over the last three trading days just since the close on Friday. Because the ceasefire has no close. We all know it. And let's talk a little bit about that. U.S. and Iran exchange military strikes to put fresh strains on ceasefire. Seems like we have a headline like this almost every freaking day, but it was particularly bad yesterday. The U.S. and Iran clashed overnight again, with Kuwait and Bahrain caught in the crossfire of one of the most serious flare-ups since the ceasefire went into effect in early April. The developments followed days of rising tension, including over Israeli operations against Tehran-backed Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. That threatened to derail U.S.-Iran talks about an interim peace deal. When did we stop calling Hezbollah terrorists? When did we start calling them militants? They're not just strongly opinionated people. They're freaking terrorists. Let's use the right word terminology here. The sides have agreed on a rough framework that should extend their truce by 2 months and reopen the Strait of Hormuz, though negotiations over the final details are dragging on. Shortly after disabling an empty oil tanker heading to Iran, the U.S. military said it came under missile and drone attack. Iran targeted the U.S. main naval base in the region located in Bahrain and the Ali al-Salem air base in Kuwait. At least one person at Kuwait's civilian airport was killed in a separate strike. The U.S. and Iran fired several ballistic missiles at its The U.S. said Iran fired several ballistic missiles at its allies, Bahrain and Kuwait, with all failing to hit their intended target, as well as drones at commercial ships. American forces struck a communications tower on the Iranian island of Keshem near the strait as part of the skirmishes. So, yeah, ceasefire, emphasis on the word fire in ceasefire, because there seems to be a lot of fire that is not really ceasing. And we're starting to get the effects of this war. I've been kind of wondering, when was the demand destruction going to show up? It hasn't really hit stateside. At least it's not showing in any of the numbers yet. It is reflected in the consumer confidence surveys, but not really any of the hard economic data. You can see it in Pakistan, though. Pakistan fuel sales slump as war boosts prices and hits demand. Fuel sales in Pakistan have slumped as costlier prices triggered by the Iran war forced consumers to cut back, according to AKD Securities. Overall sales by volume fell to 1.17 million tons in May, almost a quarter lower than the same month last year, the brokerage said in a report citing figures from the oil company's advisory council and industry group. That is severe. I mean, if you were to see something like that, if you were to see fuel sales in the U.S. decline by almost a quarter year over year, that would be instant recession here in the States. I'd imagine it's no different in Pakistan. Among individual products, sales of petrol were 12% weaker on the year at 617,000 tons, while diesel sales plunged 32% to 455,000 tons, according to the report. And that means fewer trucks on the road. That is absolutely dreadful. Diesel sales are the lowest since February of 2025, said Muhammad Ali, an analyst at AKD Securities, in a phone interview. Demand disruption from the historic price shock has come at a lag. Following earlier stockpiling, austerity measures might have also contributed to the trend, but higher fuel prices remain the dominant driver, he added. Economic activities may also be affected if low demand persists, said Ali. And yeah, he's saying we're going into a recession because of this. And India's feeling it too. Now, this was pretty interesting. We reported that India was selling gold. I think it was yesterday that the Reserve Bank of India had sold gold. And then they're coming out and they're denying it. But they're not really denying it here. India's central bank says report on selling gold is incorrect. India's central bank said a report that its selling gold is not correct, pointing to data showing its physical stock of gold has remained unchanged. Latest figures in the Reserve Bank of India's monthly bulletin show the stock of physical gold was steady at 880.52 metric tons during April. Note April there. They were steady in April. The stock was at that level as on date, the central bank said in a statement on Wednesday. Separately, the Press Information Bureau said in a post on X that the share of gold in India's foreign exchange reserves rose to 16.7% by March 31st from about 14% at the end of September. Well, yeah, the share of reserves rose because you sold your dollars and because gold went sky high from September to January. So it was still higher at the end of March. But again, as of April, the tons were unchanged. As of March 31st, more reserves. Bloomberg Economics estimated in a report on Tuesday that the central bank likely sold gold reserves worth about $12 billion for the 2 weeks through May 22nd while buying $7.5 billion of foreign currency assets. Latest data up to the end of March shows RBI held about 77% of its gold locally, up from 66% in September. So did they really refute the Bloomberg report? Bloomberg said, hey, it looked like for 2 weeks at the end of May, you sold gold. And they're saying, nuh-uh, we had this much gold as of the end of April. Well, you didn't refute the actual fact in the report. So this is one of those cases of the lady doth protest too much. They're making this big deal saying the report is incorrect. And then the data they're citing is an apples to orangutans comparison. So they're not really refuting the story. In my opinion, the weakness of this refuting actually validates the story. And it makes the Reserve Bank of India look even weaker. That's just my take on that one. And then you've also got this one coming out of India this morning. India said to be ready to cut tax, ready tax cut plans to attract foreign bond buyers. And again, this is all about shoring up their FX reserves because their currency is failing. India is poised to announce steps to draw more foreign investments by reducing taxes and removing caps on the ownership of some bonds as soon as this week, according to people with knowledge of the matter. We don't need to get into the brass tacks of the tax, but the rupee slide to record lows has prompted authorities to step up efforts to stem its decline, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi calling on citizens to conserve foreign exchange amid the surge in oil import costs. The currency has been hurt by several factors, including U.S. trade tariffs, record foreign fund outflows, and the oil shock caused by the Iran war, all of which have strained the country's finances. The rupee hit an all-time low of 96.96 on May 20th, but has since rebounded as the central bank stepped up support and oil prices eased after renewed U.S.-Iran peace efforts. The currency is the second worst performer in Asia this year, down more than 6% versus the dollar. So India looking to cut taxes to attract foreign bond buyers, all to get their hands on more dollars to defend their crumbling currency. And they also mentioned tariffs was a factor here, and that's a good segue because, well, here's tariffs. Trump begins rebuilding his tariff wall, citing forced labor. Okay, that's the tariff rationale du jour, forced labor. The U.S. is proposing new tariffs on at least 10% of imports from 60 trading partners, and President Trump's biggest move to rebuild his protectionist wall since his earlier levies were struck down by the Supreme Court. Following an investigation into how trade partners handle goods allegedly produced by forced labor, a 10% tariff rate would apply to imports from Canada, Mexico, the European Union, Taiwan, and the UK, among other places, according to a statement on Tuesday. Products from other major economies, including China, India, Japan, South Korea, Brazil, and Switzerland, would be subject to a 12.5% levy. Okay, the move is a major step in Trump's push to reinstate the tariffs he imposed during his first year in office before they were deemed unconstitutional. The recommended duties are a result of probes launched under separate legal authority known as Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. The U.S. Trade Representative investigated whether the economies involved had failed to impose a forced labor import prohibition or effectively enforce such a prohibition. None of the 60 economies whose acts, policies, and practices are the subject of these investigations effectively enforced a forced labor import prohibition, it found. Okay, that's the reason they're giving. Okay, that's fine. As a stopgap measure, the president also implemented a 10% levy under Section 122 of the trade law. Though those import taxes expire in July, the Section 122 tariffs are themselves subject to an ongoing legal challenge. Section 301 tariffs are seen as more legally sound and flexible than other powers Trump has eyed, but also more time-consuming. The Heinrich Foundation's Elms said the imposition of the newly announced tariffs is likely to coincide with the expiry of the 122 levies. So, look, they're just using forced labor as an excuse, citing this other legal basis for the tariffs, which are about to expire because of this other legal basis that Trump rolled out. And he rolled that out because of this other legal basis, IEEPA, that was struck down by the Supreme Court. So this is just the same tariffs for a different reason. Meanwhile, SpaceX is worth less than half of its $1.75 trillion IPO target, Morningstar says. Yikes, look at the ratings agencies doing due diligence here for a change. How about that? Way to go, Morningstar. Where have you been all my life? And I love this picture, by the way. This is a picture for a SpaceX article. You can see, right, there's the little tip of the rocket there, just the tip. And in the foreground, row after row of Cybertrucks. Why would they show row after row of Cybertrucks in a SpaceX article? Maybe that's because SpaceX actually was responsible for 1 in 5 Cybertrucks that were sold worldwide last year. Yeah, that headline didn't get a lot of attention. SpaceX bought thousands of Cybertrucks for some reason. Maybe it's got something to do with the CEO that the two companies share, but I digress. But I'm sure those Cybertrucks are adding a lot of value for potential SpaceX IPO shareholders, and certainly not just bailing out Tesla shareholders for a truck that is just ugly as sin. Oh my God, that thing is hideous. It looks like a prop car from Back to the Future too. Anyway, SpaceX is expected to start trading on the NASDAQ in just over 2 weeks. But Morningstar analysts have warned that Elon Musk's tech behemoth is significantly overvalued. The hotly anticipated debut is expected to be the largest ever IPO, with SpaceX reportedly targeting a $75 billion fundraise and a valuation of $1.75 trillion. We think the company has been significantly overvalued, and investors will have opportunities to buy the stock at more attractive levels after the IPO, Morningstar analyst wrote in a note published on Monday. The analyst sees a wide range of possibilities for the potential profitability of SpaceX's XAI and find that its economic moat is indeterminate. Yet they don't have one. They view the unit, XAI, as posing a material threat of value destruction to the company. Go figure. You know, XAI, which is just like, buy more GPUs at any cost. Yeah, you think maybe a material threat of value destruction? I thought the demand was insane and AI was the greatest thing since sliced bread and it's the new fire and they're going to cure cancer. All of a sudden, material threat of value destruction. Well, just remember, guys, nobody saw that coming. As such, Morningstar's discounted cash flow valuation of SpaceX is $780 billion, which is roughly 48% below its private market valuation of $1.5 trillion. And well below the valuation of almost $2 trillion that the company was seeking. Actually, I think the last number was $1.8 trillion. So let's see, 780 over 1,800. Yeah, 43% of what it's going to IPO at. But this is important here, guys. With the small initial float boosted by almost every investment bank on the planet, buoyant investor appetite for AI infrastructure bids, and an unprecedented path to inclusion in the NASDAQ 100 index just 15 trading days after the IPO, we expect SpaceX's share price will likely survive separation and may even ascend at least for a time, Morningstar said. So that's pretty interesting, that the note there. Morningstar is saying this thing is not even worth half of what they're selling it for, but because of all this other bullshit around the AI bubble, the stock is probably going to go up, at least for a time after the IPO. And I share that assessment. I mean, they're literally writing the rules to make this IPO succeed. They don't care how much they hurt people. So for a time, they'll probably do well. I'm not touching this thing with a 10-foot pole. But that being said, you know, even Morningstar, who's saying it ain't worth half of what they're advertising, is saying the stock will probably still go up. What phase? All right. Somebody want to explain this one to me? I am all ears. United States job openings increased by 731,000 to 7.618 million in April, the highest since November of 2024, and well above market expectations for just 6.88 million, highlighting labor market resilience despite rising energy costs from the Iran conflict. The number of job openings increased in professional and business services by 668,000. And I just don't know how you get that. Almost 700,000 jobs in professional and business services appeared in the month of April. This to say this was a beat is putting it mildly. This beat by like 800,000 jobs. I don't know. I hate to just point to data and say this is BS, but I cannot find an explanation for this that holds water. JOLTS way up. And you know, if you're wondering that, at the same time JOLTS went way up, we actually had the number of quits fell to 2.977 million in April from a downwardly revised 3.16 million in March. So look, the number of people quitting their jobs went down dramatically from the number in March, which was by itself lowered. When you get a surge of job openings, you typically get a surge of job quits at the same time, right? Because if the job market is good, people are more willing to leave their current position because they think they can find another one. So this is another data point. The fact that quits went down so much tells me that the JOLTS number just wasn't realistic. And again, if I'm open to suggestions, if somebody can explain where those 700,000 jobs came from, I would love to hear it. All right, we also got ADP employment change. Private businesses in the United States hired 122,000 workers in May of 2026 compared to 105,000 in April of 2026. That is slightly more than the 117,000 that the market was expecting. I would say that's a rounding error, but we'll call it a beat. 122,000, that's just kind of barely keeping up with population growth. So this is the no hire, no fire job market is what's shown here. We're going to get non-farm payrolls on Friday. Those numbers are typically more closely watched by the market. The market didn't really react when the ADP private payrolls came out. But I would say this is slightly good data. It's not nearly as good as the JOLTS would suggest, but it's at least slightly good economic data pointing to maybe the job market is starting to thaw out a little bit because it's been frozen for about a year now. All right, and we got this one in Semaphore exclusive. Anthropic resists sharing financial info with lenders, sources say. And I just love this. We want you to lend us billions of dollars, but we don't want you to ask any questions. That's what Dario Amodei is saying here. Since when can you do that? When can you borrow billions of dollars and they ask you for information and you're like, shh, I'll never tell. Speaking of that Anthropic debt deal, you know that $36 billion largest ever private credit deal that Anthropic launched just after raising $65 billion like 5 days earlier? Yeah, that one. The company has resisted sharing financial information with lenders, considering buying pieces of the debt, people familiar with the matter said. Some of the lenders being pitched to buy a slice of the $4.6 billion notes that don't have a backstop from Broadcom, meaning they are pure exposure to Anthropic, say they haven't received a detailed look at the AI company's numbers, causing some to pass on the deal, the people said. You think? I mean, at least some passed on the deal. Why didn't all of them pass on the deal? Can I borrow $1 billion? Can you pay me back? I can't tell you that. Okay, here's my billion. Apparently, some people passed on that. Go figure. Such disclosures are standard in lending deals. The transaction is expected to be completed before Anthropic's IPO documents filed confidentially to regulators this week are made public. So its future stockholders and its current creditors are likely to find out at the same time what's happening under the hood. Anthropic didn't comment. You've got to be kidding me. This information is going to be public in a couple of weeks anyway. Why would you not share this information unless this information is so bad you don't want it to get out before your IPO? I don't know. But I'm telling you guys, these AI guys just give me the heebie-jeebies here. And all these private credit CEOs who were out and be like, oh, don't worry, we've got rigorous underwriting standards and our proprietary algorithms, and only the finest debt instruments make it into our portfolios. And that's why Cliffwater Private Credit Fund stung by 17% redemption requests. Oh, yeah, these are back. And you're going to get more of them, guys. Cliffwater's flagship private credit fund capped redemptions at 5% in the second quarter after investors looked to pull about 17% of shares in a sign of enduring pressure on the $1.8 trillion market. The $31 billion Cliffwater Corporate Lending Fund informed shareholders Tuesday they'd get about one-third of their requested money back, according to a letter seen by Bloomberg. The prior quarter, investors got back around half of the roughly 14% that they asked for, with the vehicle choosing to cap withdrawals at 7%. All right, so right away, things are getting worse, even though we've been told the worst is behind us in private credit by people who are not believable. Last quarter, 14% requested, 7% returned. This quarter, 17% requested, 5% returned. The requests are getting bigger and the redemptions are getting smaller. You notice that? Other non-traded business development companies are set to report the results on their second quarter tender offers in the coming weeks. In the previous period, some like Blackstone's BCRED went to extraordinary lengths to let investors cash out, while other funds at Apollo, BlackRock, and Blue Owl enforced their 5% caps. Get ready, guys. We're going to cover every single one of them. More and more funds are going to be capping their redemptions, typically at that 5% mark. People want their money back, and they can't have it because these are illiquid assets that they can't sell, at least not at the prices they advertise to their investors, because they've all been lying for years. And it's not just private credit. Now it's private equity also getting in on the capping of redemptions. Partners caps Evergreen Fund redemptions as requests rise. Partners Group Holding is capping withdrawals at one of its Evergreen private equity funds amid heightened redemption pressure, as the investor anxiety that hit private credit vehicles shows signs of spilling over to other asset classes within private markets, just as we're shoveling this crap into people's 401ks because democratizing, that's at least what we're told. The Swiss firm, one of Europe's largest listed alternative asset managers, said its $8.6 billion global value SICAV fund was limiting redemptions to 5% of net asset value per quarter after withdrawal requests surged to an estimated 9.8% in the second quarter. There's been a pickup in redemption requests from private wealth clients across the firm's Evergreen portfolio, a spokesman for Partners Group said. Such clients, who are typically far more skittish than institutional investors, make up about a fifth of assets under management across the platform and a particularly large portion of Global Value's investor base. In April, Grizzly Research had targeted Partners Group, saying it was shorting the stock, citing alleged valuation inconsistencies in Evergreen funds, where it's estimated as much as 40% of investments may be significantly mismarked. And in other words, exactly what Jack has been saying for years, but I digress. Grizzly said it had identified discrepancies between reported valuations and underlying performance. But Partners Group, based near Zug, Switzerland, said valuations are validated by third parties and broadly termed Grizzly's claims as frivolous, defamatory, and highly misleading. All right, so they say, no, our marks are accurate. Our net asset value is totally accurate, even though we can't sell our products at those numbers, and that's why we're getting redemptions. They're validated by third parties. So let's talk about that third-party validation, what that might look like, because we had an excellent post from Jeff Gundlach just the other day on X, and I really like this. And when you hear about these third-party validations of net asset value, just keep this scenario in your mind. And Gundlach says, say private credit fund X owns loan A marked at 100 or 100 cents on dollar, face value basically. And then you've got private credit fund Y owns loan B marked at that same 100%. Both X and Y know A and B are really only worth 65 cents on the dollar. So X and Y agree to trade in and out of loans. X buys B from Y, and Y buys A from X, both at a price of 100, and say, see, our net asset value is solid. It's like two Beanie Baby collectors, right? Each of them paid $100,000 for a Beanie Baby in 1991. And now they're like, okay, you buy my Beanie Baby for $100,000. I'll buy your Beanie Baby for $100,000. No actual money changes hands. And then they hold up their Beanie Babies and say, see, it's still worth $100,000. By the way, this is exactly what Qwest Communication and Global Crossing did during the dot-com bubble with fiber optic capacity. It's totally illegal. And Gunlock is saying this as like a hypothetical scenario here. Just maybe a guy like Gunlock has heard something about somebody doing this, and that's why he's giving out this hypothetical scenario on X. But when you hear about these third-party valuations of net asset value marks, keep that in mind, guys. Hey, I just want to say, everybody, thank you for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget the like button and the subscribe button on the way out. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melonheads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. You guys are awesome. Links down below, should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.